ambivalence, self-delusion, fear. Henry Fleming feels them all. Fleming, or the youth, as he's called, is the fictional hero of Stephen Crane's classic novel, The Red Badge of Courage. More than a century ago, it was one of the first American novels to look at the psychological impact of combat. NPR's Elizabeth Blair spotlights Henry Fleming for our series In Character.
When The Red Badge of Courage was first published in the 1890s, some Civil War veterans were amazed at how Henry Fleming seemed to feel almost exactly the way they did in battle. Michael Schaefer is an English professor at the University of Central Arkansas.
There are even stories of veterans of the Civil War writing into newspapers saying, "Oh, I'm so glad to see Steve Crane publishing this because he and I were in the same regiment and he's a good guy."
But they were mistaken. Stephen Crane wasn't even born when the Civil War ended. But Civil War veterans were still alive when he was writing, and it's almost certain that Crane talked to them about their experiences. In many ways, Henry Fleming is a typical raw recruit and a typical teenager. When he joins the Union Army, he's got big ideas of what glorious battles await him, and he's eager to impress his friends and a brown-haired girl he likes. But pretty quickly, he questions himself and his courage. In 1951, John Huston made a film version of Red Badge. Henry Fleming was played by Audie Murphy, who in real life was the most decorated U.S. combat soldier of World War II.
How do you know you won't run when the time comes?
Run? Me?
Well, plenty of good enough men have thought they was going to do great things before the fight, but when the time comes, they skedaddle.
He's afraid of being afraid. So, you know, on the eve of battle, he's wondering, what am I going to do? Am I going to run? Am I going to stand and fight? Are my friends going to see that I'm a man, that I'm brave, or are they going to see that I'm a coward?
Stephen Crane most likely based Red Badge of Courage on one of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War in Chancellorsville, Virginia.
Oh, you look off to our left and right. You can't see 25 yards in either direction.
Walking through the thick, dense woods where the Battle of Chancellorsville took place, John Hennessy, a historian with the National Park Service, says the most intense fighting began on May 3rd, 1863.
And on that morning, about 6 hours of fighting, about 18,000 men would fall, killed and wounded. Now, if you do the math, that comes down to about one man every second.
The army, writes Stephen Crane, was helpless in the matted thickets. Henry's neck was quivering with nervous weakness. The muscles of his arms felt numb and bloodless. When Henry sees other soldiers running, he runs himself, like a rabbit. Crane's prose echoes real accounts of what happened at Chancellorsville. John Hennessy found a letter by a Union soldier watching his comrades run away.
He said the retreat was headlong. They had thrown away everything that was loose, guns, knapsacks, caps, and many had no coat or blouse. They were crazed and fought to escape, as though the enemy were close to them. We were ordered to stop them, but we might as well have tried to stop a cyclone. They dived through our line regardless of our guns and bayonets.
Not only does Henry run, but he justifies his running in his head. He sees a squirrel and throws a pine cone at it. The squirrel runs away.
And Henry thinks, aha, if it's natural for the squirrel to run away, it must be natural for me to have run away as well.
Paul Sorrentino is a professor at Virginia Tech who's writing a biography of Stephen Crane. He says Henry Fleming is a complex character. He both pities and envies the other soldiers who stayed and fought. He feels guilty that he left, but superior that he made the natural decision to save himself.
With the story in which we have a boy whose thoughts are constantly going back and forth between clarity and vagueness about what is war all about? What does it mean to be brave? Did I do the right thing?
And even though Henry Fleming questions himself on what seems like every page of the Red Badge of Courage, he can't seem to set himself straight. While he's separated from his regiment, he comes across more soldiers fleeing. In a panic, one of them hits Henry on the head with the butt of his rifle. Later, Henry finds his regiment again.
Henry Fleming!
Yeah, it's me.
Well, old boy. By ginger, I'm glad to see you. I give you up for a goner. I thought you was dead, sure enough.
Well, I've had an awful time. I've been all over, way over on the right. I got separated from the regiment. Terrible fighting over there. And I got shot, too.
Got shot?
Yeah, I got shot in the head.
He was inventing all sorts of excuses for his own cowardice in the face of enemy fire.
That's Joe Galloway, co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. As a war correspondent in Vietnam, he was with the 7th Cavalry at the Ia Drang Valley when they were surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Galloway says there have been Henry Flemings in every war.
Korea is rife with instances of guys who shot themselves in the foot with their own rifle just so they could get out of combat. They were willing to do that or were willing to have a friend shoot them in the leg. Anything, because they were absolutely terrified.
By the end of the Red Badge of Courage, Henry Fleming is transformed from the scared youth who runs to someone outraged and hungry to fight. Stephen Crane writes that Henry lost sense of everything but his hate, his desire to smash into pulp the glittering smile of victory which he could feel upon the faces of his enemies. Park Service historian John Hennessy found this account from a real soldier who fought at Chancellorsville.
My two tent mates were wounded, and after that I acted like a madman. I was stronger than I had been before, and a kind of desperation seized me. I snatched a gun from the hands of a man who was shot through the head as he staggered and fell. At other times I would have been horror-struck and could not have moved, but at this time I jumped over dead men with as little feeling as I would over a log.
The Red Badge of Courage has been called a coming-of-age novel, but there's been debate about what Stephen Crane is saying about courage, heroism, and maturity. At the end, Crane no longer calls Henry Fleming the youth, but rather a man. Joe Galloway isn't sure that's true.
I'm not sure what war really makes you except sad. I don't know that it makes you a man or that the army is the way to make yourself a man. That's an awful high price to pay. There's a very steep learning curve in combat.
Stephen Crane brought his fictional Henry Fleming back to life in a later work called The Veteran. Now an old man, Henry admits that he ran and that he was afraid. I thought the sky was falling down. I thought the world was coming to an end. You bet I was scared. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
There are clips from the movie version of Red Badge of Courage at npr.org. Also, a conversation about in-character and the hero, Henry Fleming. Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook. TV's Emmy nominations were unveiled this week. The big moment? Here's host Kristen Chenoweth.
The nominations in the drama series category are Boston Legal, Damages, Dexter, House, Lost, and Mad Men.
Mad Men got the big whoops Thursday and the most drama nominations, 16 of them. Huh, never watched it? Never heard of it? Well, you're in good company. Mad Men only gets a million viewers a week. Compare that to American Idol's 30 million a week. Ed Bark, you're a TV critic. What's that about?
Well, it's up to the Emmy people to recognize quality above all else, regardless of a show's popularity. So that is their first job. And, you know, a lot more basic cable networks such as AMC, this Mad Men was their first venture into an original scripted drama. This is suddenly the signature show of the network.
I thought this was the place where you saw black and white movies.
Yeah. Well, you know, now they've got commercials and they've mostly gone to color and they've ruined the channel otherwise, so they might as well have Mad Men.
And Mad Men is about an advertising agency?
Yeah, it's about a Madison Avenue 1960s era ad agency.
So, what do you fellas do?
You're looking at the finest ad men in New York. Hell, the world.
Bringing in business is the key to your salary, your status, and your self-worth.
Sounds stylish.
A lot of cigarette smoking in that series, which, you know, a broadcast network couldn't put on this series, I don't think.
Huh.
They couldn't. They certainly couldn't reflect what was the reality at the time. A lot of heavy straight liquor drinking and chain smoking.
The other leading Emmy shows are from the biggie networks. John Adams on HBO, 30 Rock on NBC, that stars Tina Fey. But these are not exactly rating superstars either.
No, John Adams didn't do any business when you compare it to The Sopranos or Sex and the City on HBO. And 30 Rock is NBC's lowest rated comedy. But it still set a single-season record for comedy nominations with 17.
This is going to sound really weird, but you need to wear a bra.
Oh, no, I don't actually. They kind of just stay up on their own.
Okay. What I'm saying is...
30 Rock has a 3.8 overall Nielsen rating. MASH in its heyday was doing a 27-point-something Nielsen rating.
Wow.
That means that 27% of all homes with television sets were watching MASH on a given episode.
Our program originates from the swamp, which is the subject of a picture spread in next month's Toilet and Garden.
A critic in the LA Times wrote that the network's comedies and dramas are, quote, becoming expensive diversions for the cultural elite, akin to opera in the 19th century.
That's a little bit of an overstatement. I mean, you know, the nominees also include House, which is very popular, Boston Legal, which does pretty well. And the comedy nominees do include Two and a Half Men, which is the most watched comedy on network TV. The problem is there aren't many comedies at all on network TV anymore. There's just a much higher percentage of American Idols and Survivors and
Greatest American Dog.
JD and Galaxy proved to be fierce competitors in the Dog Bone Challenge.
Greatest American Dog, it's fine. I mean, it's about, you know, poor dog is trying to get ahead in the world. It's okay.
Maybe it has to do with your name. Ed Bark is a longtime TV critic. He runs the website UncleBarky.com. Thanks, Uncle Barky.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. What would Oprah do? Fans of the talk show host sometimes ask themselves that question. One woman has not only asked herself the question, she's used the question to create a template for her life. She follows Oprah's every recommendation, what food to cook, what kind of bra to buy, relationship advice, everything. Between the Oprah Winfrey television show, the Oprah website, and O Magazine, it turns out to be quite a task. She calls herself Lo. That's L-O, as in Living Oprah. Her real name is Robin Okrent. She's an actress. She lives in Chicago, just like Oprah. And she runs a website, you guessed it, called livingoprah.com. She joins us now from Chicago. And for the purposes of this conversation, may I call you Robin?
Oh, yes, you can. I'm so used to hearing Lo, but sure, let's
okay.
do it.
Well, from this point on, you'll be Robin, at least to me.
All right.
Tell me, what inspired you to do this, to live Oprah 24/7?
You know what? I was feeling really strongly about the fact that I think that women do not ask why enough. You know, we are told we have to dress a certain way. We're told we have to, you know, get flat abs in 2 weeks. We're told we're not allowed to get old. And we follow these programs sort of blindly without asking why or is it important to us? And I think Oprah is the most influential person in the media today. And I think that's where we're getting a lot of our information. You know, the tagline of her website is live your best life. And I think those are pretty strong words. So I wanted to see what would happen if I did everything Oprah said, and if indeed by the end of this year, I would be living my best life.
And you've been doing this for about how long?
Well, I've been doing it since January 1st.
Okay, so you're not quite at the one-year point.
No. Mm-mm.
But how's mm-mm. it going so far?
Well, I was going to say I'm not at the one-year point, but I'm at the breaking point. No, I'm a little on the exhausted side because things are taking far more time than I had really thought they would. So there are a lot of things I have to shop for. There are a lot of ways I have to dress. But there are also ways I have to behave. Like I have to savor every meal. I have to be content every time I walk in the front door. So, you know, there's a long list to complete on a daily basis. So it's tiring.
Now, you are looking for soap products, for white jeans, for leopard print flats.
I'm wearing them today.
Things yeah. for the jeans or the flats?
The flats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, all kinds of things for your home, for your garden. Who is bankrolling this?
I am, which is also the tough part. I am not independently wealthy. And I've actually been offered sponsorship to do this. And I think it's really important to this sort of social experiment that everything come out of my pocket, you know, that I actually feel, I feel the pain.
How much money have you spent so far?
So far, just about $2,000, but I still have a decent sized list of things that I have not purchased yet.
Now, you have quite a long disclaimer on the site. You say that you are in no way connected to the Oprah Winfrey Show,
right.
Harpo, Oprah's Favorite Things, Oprah and Friends. So you're not connected to Oprah,
mm-hmm.
but are you at all aware that she's looking over your shoulder?
You know, yeah, there's a slight paranoia there. But, you know, the disclaimer on the site was something that, you know, I just wanted to protect myself and make sure no one thought I was trying to steal from Oprah in any way whatsoever. So
what do you think she would think of this?
I think she would think that it was ridiculous that someone someone would be doing everything. That I get the sense that she'd think there's not enough time in the day to actually take care of what we need to do in our own lives. So why spend so much time doing every little word of advice that she says? But I would hope she would be a little curious, too. I hope.
Now, I know this is a kind of internet-based social activism on your part, but are you also in some way just making fun of Oprah?
No. No, I don't think so. That's not my intention at all, actually. Really, to spend a whole year making fun of someone is, I'd have to have, I don't know, a lot of bitterness, I think, inside me to want to do that. And in fact, I want to be really clear, too, that I actually admire her quite a bit. And I think there's actually a lot to learn from her.
Robin, I listened to the way you said no when I asked if you were making fun of Oprah, and I have in my mind that old television commercial, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. You know, one doesn't poke fun at Oprah Winfrey.
Right. Yeah, no, I feel almost like as much as I'm critiquing her, I also feel like I'm challenging us as an audience, you know, because I do want us to look at the way that we, you know, we take celebrities and we put them on a pedestal and then we, you know, place really high expectations on them and then we look to them for answers. And, you know, I think we should reflect on, you know, how we're part of that sort of symbiotic relationship of creating these celebrity gurus. So yeah, that's more important to me than the making fun of Oprah.
Well, lo and behold, we are out of time.
Ba-dum-bum.
It's been good to talk to you, Robin.
Good to talk to you, too. Thank you.
Robin Okrent is a Chicago actress who's spending the year following the advice of Oprah Winfrey, all of the advice of Oprah Winfrey, and she's blogging about the experience at livingoprah.com.
Here's a new checklist for you. Recycle, yeah. Drive a Prius, check. Love life, not so great. Some environmentalists are having a tough time finding true love. NPR's Ben Bergman sat in on a gathering of singles in Santa Monica, California, that organizers dubbed a green speed dating event.
You know, it's hard enough finding singles in LA with dashing good looks, a witty sense of humor, and a steady job. Tonight, there is another challenge. They've also got to have a low carbon footprint. Even environmentalists have their limits, though, so everyone valet parks. This is LA, after all. And what do these tree huggers drive?
I drive an SUV.
An SUV?
I have a Land Rover, a Range Rover.
Jeff Sabrucher is a hedge fund manager who lives in downtown LA. He says he's been trying really hard to get rid of his gas guzzler.
Do you consider yourself green?
Well, I recycle. That's pretty much what I do, actually. I recycle, and I try to donate money to causes, green causes.
Sabrucha is one of about 16 singles here, mostly in their 30s and 40s. They have mere minutes to see if the sparks fly before organizer Vince Dell sounds his horn, and daters make the choice.
If you like somebody, pick yes in the match form. If you don't like them, pick no, but not in front of their face, okay?
No awkward exchange of numbers, no stinging face-to-face rejections.
At the end of the event, sometime tonight, I'll give you your mutual matches, so if you both pick yes, you'll get an email saying so-and-so likes you.
Dell says the key to effective speed dating is to say as little as possible.
For guys, don't talk too much. The more you say it, the more ammunition women have to reject you.
You want to leave them wanting more.
Exactly. Be mysterious, that way you get a second date.
A few minutes may not seem like much, but actually Dell says in speed dating, time is the enemy.
We ask every person at these events how much time they need. Guys need about 5 seconds, women need about 10. And so 3 minutes is more than enough. But the 3 minutes will kill you, though. They might like you after the first 5 seconds, but 2 minutes later that you're gone.
Hoping to avoid that fate, Jeff Sabrucha sits down at a small table across from Felicia Williams. Their date begins like all do, with awkward small talk.
Where are you from, Felicia?
So I live in Pasadena.
Okay. There's a lot of Pasadena people here for some reason. Yeah, there's like three of them already so far.
Oh, I didn't know. We should have carpooled.
Luckily, the horn sounds before the Prius driving Williams has a chance to ask Sarucha what he drives.
Okay, nice meeting you too. What's your name again?
Jeff,
okay.
Maybe Williams will have more luck with the next guy, aerospace consultant Francois Jacquet.
I'm very green.
Jacquet is so green that he does something even better than drive a hybrid.
And you know why? I don't own a car. I ride a bicycle. I walk all the time. Whenever I absolutely need a car, make a list of things I need to do, I rent one. I feel that this is pretty green, okay?
Okay, at the end of the night, everyone turns in their match forms. Everyone except Jacquet, that is, because unfortunately, no one is green enough for him.
Let's say somebody does all their shopping at Whole Foods Network. They drive a Prius and throughout all their working incandescent lights. All those efforts are misguided, but at least they tried, you know? I didn't even see anybody like that here. I mean, we can't all drive a bicycle like I do. But I want to see people at a green speed dating event that have at least tried, done something. But hey, let's have more of these. I think they're great.
Plans are already in the works for more green speed dating, this time in Orange County, California. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.